The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
It's my pleasure to introduce our guests to the Free Library stage tonight, Barbara McQuaid. Yes, yes, yes. She is a legal expert for MSNBC and NBC News and a co-host of the podcast Sisters in Law. Yeah, I love it. Oh, I'm sorry. Set me straight. Hashtag Sisters in Law. Thank you. I got to get a shirt. Okay. She teaches courses in criminal law and criminal procedure, national security, and data privacy at the University of Michigan Law School. That deserves a round of applause. I'm a fellow attorney, too, so I'm in love with her already. Okay, back to her. The first woman to serve in her position from 2010 to 2017, she was the U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan. Her early career included work as a sports writer and copy editor, and a judicial law clerk, and an associate in a private practice, and an assistant U.S. Attorney. In Attack from Within, McQuaid presents an encompassing examination of the ways in which mass disinformation is damaging democracy, while also offering a practical guide to shoring up the institutions, technology, and policies beset by those with an interest in dividing us. Joining McQuaid on stage is Ali Velshi. Yes, he is. He's brilliant, along with Barbara. I told him that I saw him in the airport one day, and I said, I didn't want to bother you. He said, no, next time, come say hello. So, but we both were trying to make our flight. He is an award-winning journalist, host of Velshi, and chief correspondent for MSNBC, and a weekly economics contributor to NPR's Here and Now. He has been nominated for multiple Emmy Awards and is the recipient of 2 National Headliner Awards and a Society of Professional Journalists Sigma Delta Chi Award. We are so pleased to have them with us this evening. Please join me in welcoming Barbara McQuaid and Ali Velshi to the stage.
That's a crowd. Thank you all. And what an honor. What an honor to be in front of you, to be back in Philly, to be at it would be an honor to be at any library anytime these days for what these librarians do for society. But to be here in this grand building and at this remarkable free library, and I always wondered why they kept the word free in it, because it's the point. The point is, this is actually for people to come in and be able to have access to anything they choose to read on their terms. So what a real honor. But this is the reason I'm here. Barbara is not just a colleague at MSNBC. That's not the important part, because she's called upon to be available to us when she can be on matters of great import, which occur every 4 to 6 hours now. But Barbara's really been a friend, because she's gone above and beyond for me in helping me learn things, in being available, because I anchor some ungodly hours on TV sometimes. But Barbara's available to us. And where we have examined things in greater depth that would use her expertise, including when I've traveled to Michigan to do particular stories, or when we have examined an issue that is related to the book that she's put out, because we have obviously, we go into great depth on these issues on MSNBC, Barbara has always been available. She is one of the most accessible, personal people who have achieved what she has achieved in the world. To meet somebody who's as accomplished and as smart as she is, and yet is available to answer our questions is an amazing thing, and this is a thing we're going to share tonight. I will ask Barbara some questions on the basis of her wonderful book, and then you will as well. We will have mics for you, and we will. I'll remind you of this when we come to you, but I would ask, because we're podcasting this, I would ask that you identify yourself and try and keep your question shorter than a thesis, but, you know, we are at a library, and you are readers, so that's okay. Barbara, what an honor. What a pleasure to be with you.
Well, thank you so much, Ellie. First, let me thank you for agreeing to moderate this. I'm just thrilled. I know you've done a lot of work on authoritarianism and banned books, and what a great place to be to talk about this topic. So thank you so very much.
Perfect. I've got my pre-publication copy of it here, and have taken more notes than I've ever taken on anything, because for those of you who have had a chance to read the book already, and that you'd have to be a pretty fast reader, it's got a lot of very specific, detailed information. Barbara's really researched this book. So I want to start, Barbara, with some basics, and we're going to get into some pretty complicated stuff here, but basics. You're calling it an attack from within, how disinformation is sabotaging America. Disinformation and misinformation. Most of us have become clearer on this over the years. They're often used interchangeably, but they mean something different. And there's as a lawyer and as a prosecutor, the concept of what you intend is relevant.
Yeah, so as I define it in the book, disinformation is the deliberate use of lies to deceive people. Misinformation is its sort of unwitting cousin. When people read something that's false and they believe it to be true, and then they spread it to others exponentially, is misinformation. And the two work hand in hand to get lies out there and spread among other people. And it's really easy to become a spreader of misinformation. Yeah. I can recall a time I did it myself. I read an article on social media that said that Patrick Mahomes, the quarterback of the Kansas City Chiefs. Sorry, Eagles fans, I know. Too soon. I'm a Lions fan, I know. Too soon. But the article said he had refused to take another snap until the Chiefs changed their name to something that was not offensive to Native Americans. And I thought, that's amazing. And so I retweeted that and got that out there. And then later in the day, I was discussing it with my husband and son. Did you see this story about Patrick Mahomes? And they said, no, I haven't seen that at all. And as I started saying it, they said, are you sure that's real? It sounds kind of fake. And as I was saying it out loud, I was saying, yeah, it does sound kind of fake. But I said, I'll go back and find it. I saw it, and it looked very legitimate. And I go back and look at it, and I saw it did come from ESPN, but it said Sprotts Center, which, of course, is not accurate. The name is actually Sports Center, so I took it down immediately. It turns out it was fake, and I had fallen for it
right. Because
I had violated some of the rules about checking for disinformation, getting excited about something, right. And wanting to share it with the world. And so that's how misinformation, we can fall for it and be unwitting spreaders of disinformation.
So there's that. There's the unwitting spreading of it, and then there's this other cousin to it in which you believe it, and then you start arguing with people about it. You use it as your position in an argument in things that are of great national import.
Yeah, I think one of the things that we have seen happen over recent years is that we hear these things that are part of not just a political viewpoint, but political identity.
Right.
And we have seen, I think, polarization like we've never seen before in recent years. You know, Ezra Klein has a good book on this called Why We're So Polarized. And he says it's a deliberate strategy of campaigns to divide us, to get us all riled up, to think that this election is an existential crisis and we've got to get out there. And so to demonize our opponents, and it causes us to want to be part of our team and aligned with our team and convinced that our team is right. And too many of us are choosing tribe over truth. And so sometimes you see people online defending a position that they know is wrong. Like,
right. You
know, all these election deniers. There are some people out there who I'm sure truly believe that Donald Trump won the 2020 election. But I am just as sure that there are many other people who don't believe it for a minute, but they're willing to say it because it has become a part of their identity. Like, did anybody see this footage of Steve Bannon at the CPAC conference over the weekend where he got the crowd chanting, Trump won, Trump won, Trump won? I think that was there. You know, I'm sure there are some people in the crowd who believe it, but there are many more who just state it as a matter of political identity, of political tribe. And that is where it becomes, I think, so damaging and corrosive to democracy.
The interesting thing about that is it's full circle, because Steve Bannon said that Donald Trump would not accept the outcome of the election.
Yeah.
It's his script that he's seeing. Let's talk about the connection between disinformation and authoritarianism. One of the things you talk about in the first chapter of the book, you cite a woman at a Trump rally here in Pennsylvania who told a reporter, quote, "There's only two teams, Team Jesus and Team Lucifer, and it's very easy to pick a side," end quote. We hear versions of this all the time. There was a woman in Iowa, right, the night of the caucuses or just before that, who said he's like Jesus Christ. He's taking things for, you know, on our behalf.
Yeah, well, this is an old trick of authoritarians. This is something Hitler did. This is something Mussolini did.
Yep.
And it is this idea of I am both every man and I am godlike. And so, you know, when Donald Trump talks about coming down the golden escalator, I mean, that's a big part of the image, and being strong and this illusion of wealth. We're learning maybe not so much. Maybe it's emphasis on the illusion. I alone can fix it. I could shoot someone in Fifth Avenue and not lose any votes. Disdain for the courts. I'm above the law. All of these kinds of things are projecting this, godlike image of someone. Muammar Gaddafi used to do it with, you know, pictures of his head everywhere. They're everywhere. Pictures of, you know, the great leader, whether it was, Lenin or Stalin, everywhere, that they are larger than life, but they're there because they are representing us. Trump is very fond of saying things like, when DOJ goes after me, mm-hmm. they're not after me, they're after you.
And I'm like, what did they after you for?
Yeah. And I'm just standing in the way.
Yes. Yeah.
And you're right, like, what do you mean? What are you talking about? It's crazy. But he says those things and people believe it. Like, yeah, they're what the message is they, I think, are others, black and brown people, immigrants, the LGBTQ community, you know, anything other than the white supremacy theory of America. They're after you, and I'm standing in their way, and I'm going to protect your way of life. And so he's created this, you know, godlike image that he's going to save this vision of America, their identity. And so I think that is what makes him untouchable and believable, and Team Jesus versus Team Lucifer.
So the problem is that we hear these things and we think they're funny. But, you know, you cite a few examples. First of all, where Donald Trump actually sold digital trading cards of himself as Superman. And I remember now a letter from Donald Trump's doctor. This is the first time around when he ran for president, stating that his strength and stamina are extraordinary, and if elected, he would be the healthiest individual ever elected to the presidency. And then there was that one in the middle of his term, which was as ridiculous. But we see it and we think, that's ridiculous. No one's going to believe this. But your book is all about people who believe stuff that's ridiculous.
Yeah, you know, in the same way we see Putin, you know, shirtless, or he plays in these hockey games and scores, you know, 9 goals single-handedly. Mussolini, the same, used to be posed shirtless and, you know, shoveling and looking strong. It's about this idea of projecting strength. It is also this admiration for other strong men, like we are all part of this same club. That is also part of this projection of authoritarianism. It is this idea that this father figure is going to take care of us and solve all of our problems. And we don't need to think about it. We don't need to question him, because he's got us all figured out, and he's smarter than we are and wealthier than we are and stronger than we are. And so we can take comfort in that, because the world's a scary place, but we've got this strong man who is going to protect us from all that scary stuff and all those other people who are trying to take over the country as I know it.
And at the same time, he's strong, and like many of these other historical figures who you've quoted, he is patriotic, or at least that's what he is conveying, that this is about the real America, the flag. In fact, it's a bit of an issue, because there are a lot of people who are not Trump supporters or acolytes who are a bit worried now when they see a flag. Or somebody with a flag on their cap, and there have been arguments to say that everybody should just go out and get a hat that has a flag on it and put a big flag outside your house and just reclaim the symbols of mm-hmm. this country's patriotism,
mm-hmm.
because that's what's happened.
Yes. So in my book, I make the argument that we should be patriotic by challenging authoritarians and by challenging the mega right and by those who want to defeat democracy. That to me is true patriotism. But what Donald Trump does is something that Hitler did, which is to evoke this nostalgia, this time of when things used to be better, to talk about how the country's really bad now, we're declining, American carnage. And there was a time in the old days when things were good. Make America great again, right? Suggest that there was a time when America was great and we're not there anymore, but we can do it again. And what was the great image? The great image was, you know, a society of white supremacy, of male supremacy, of Christian supremacy, of straight supremacy, and, you know, others were out there somewhere, but they knew their place in life, and they didn't try to acquire too much or to achieve too much, and they knew their place in their order. And so achieving that again is this idea of making America great again. And then, you know, really trying to seize these images. Like, Donald Trump literally hugs the flag yeah. when he goes on stage to try to claim it, right? Yeah, can we get an ooh? I agree. Ooh. But walking across Lafayette Square with the Bible, which I think he held upside down, by the way, to demonstrate his power over protesters right. who were protesting the Black Lives Matter movement. And so he is trying to seize on Christianity. You know, he has pastors come in and put hands on him. I imagine they have to wash their hands afterwards because they've never touched such a filthy man. But he is trying to claim those things, and so people who do love America and do love their religion and love their God can feel comfortable that this is someone who represents them. And to me, he is the antithesis of what America is supposed to be.
As a journalist, yes, that does deserve applause. It's not uncommon for politicians to feel threatened by journalists. In my opinion, there should be a healthy tension between journalists and our elected officials, and we have all blurred that line over the years. But Donald Trump has taken that to a new level. He has described the media as the enemy of the people. I think Stalin is the first one recorded to have said that, but this has worked. He does this. He used to do this at all his rallies. He'd talk about all of them out there. By the way, sometimes there weren't a lot of them out there, but it made it seem mm-hmm. like mm-hmm. I'm here, they're the enemy, and they're your enemy.
Yeah, and as you said, this is something that authoritarians have done throughout history, which is to criticize the critics and undermine the critics so that when they inevitably criticize the leader, we have already laid the groundwork that they are not to be believed. So enemy of the people as the press. Hitler used the phrase Lügenpresse, which meant lying press. Same idea, undermine the press, which of course is a watchdog for society. The Fourth Estate, free press, is one of our most treasured First Amendment rights. And it doesn't end with just the press, too. It's also career government officials, scientists, and other professionals who work in our government, but whom he calls the deep state, right? Because that suggests that there is some shadowy government controlling all of us that are going on. Undermining other potential critics, the courts, protesters, other people who might be critical of you. You have to undermine all of these people so that when the criticism ultimately comes, we can dismiss them as, unelected bureaucrats, the deep state, the enemy of the people.
You write in the book that disinformation operations, meaning by those who deliberately set it out to be disinformation, are engaging in what, these are your words, engaging in what intelligence experts refer to as active measures, methodical psychological operations programmed to manipulate targeted populations. Whether people believe the messages of such operations is of secondary importance. Instead, the operation's primary goal is the reactive emotions that result from mere exposure.
Yeah, so there are a lot of things that we can learn from Russian active measures and something called reflexive control. It's kind of like the psychology you might practice on your kids, right? Don't you eat those peas? And you know what the reaction is going to be. But it's something very similar. You know, I'll just give you an example of it. Remember when the Access Hollywood tape came out just before the 2016 election? And that was big news. It was just before the election. There were a lot of politicians who were distancing themselves from Donald Trump. And it was the next day that Russia chose to release the DNC emails that they had hacked that showed a lot of, you know, palace drama in the Democratic Party. Because what Russia knew is that our media would take the bait. They like what shiny, new, controversy. And so that became the headline, and the Access Hollywood tape got off the front pages of our newspapers. In the same way, when William Barr got the Robert Mueller report, he engaged in active measures, right? He read it himself. He kept it under lock and key for, 2 weeks while he wrote his own summary of it and issued that to the public. That was very misleading. Even Robert Mueller himself, who is not prone to complaining or whining, said that the summary that William Barr put out was a misleading summary of what his report actually said. But what he said is that there was no evidence of a conspiracy and that there was no obstruction of justice, when in fact, Robert Mueller found all kinds of contacts between Trump and Russia, the meeting at Trump Tower between the campaign and Russia, the sharing of polling data, and the coordinating of messages with WikiLeaks was some very concerning disloyal behavior by the Trump campaign. And although not amounting to a crime of conspiracy, certainly contacts that existed between those. And then what Robert Mueller said is, you know, a sitting president can't be charged, but here's an awful lot of evidence of obstruction of justice. So I'm not going to reach a conclusion, but there you go. And, you know, someone can be charged when they end their presidency. And so what William Barr said was, well, Robert Mueller concluded there's no conspiracy, and he said he couldn't reach a conclusion about obstruction of justice, so I've looked at the evidence and I've reached a conclusion, right, and there's no obstruction of justice. By the time that report came out 2 weeks later, people had moved on, as William Barr knew they would. And so there are many people who never bothered to read the full report. It's long. It takes a lot of work. Even the executive summary, people thought, I know what it says. And what Donald Trump said repeatedly on social media and at his rallies was that the Mueller report completely exonerated him.
Yep.
And people believed that because that's what he said, and that was the message they got. And by the time the details came out, they had moved on. That is the kind of reflexive control I'm talking about. It's influence. It's manipulating the way our brains are wired to cause us to think something or ignore something or pay attention to something that distracts us from the more important facts.
So this is not a reading, but it will be for a moment, because I would like to read from page 79 on this topic, in which you say, according to a study by the Columbia Journalism Review, in 6 days leading up to the election, the Times ran 10 front page stories about Clinton's emails, a number equal to the front page stories it ran about all other campaign policy issues in the 69 days before the election. The mainstream media's repetition of disinformation gives it the patina of credibility. Reputable journalists struggle with how to cover false claims. Is it best to ignore them or to repeat them with sufficient context to allow readers to understand how they conflict with verifiable facts? Most reporters consider it newsworthy to report a false statement simply because it's made by a high-ranking public official, like a president or a senator. But repeating the claim, even if only to debunk it, exposes the public to the manipulation coded into the disinformation.
Well, you actually have read this book, haven't you, Allie? I'm impressed. The hardest working man in television news, I'll tell you that. Yeah, I think this is a real struggle, and I don't know the correct answer to this, but I think that journalists grew up with this idea that you present both sides of a story and you allow people to draw their own conclusions about things. But I think that presumes that most actors are acting in good faith and that they have a common set of facts and maybe different viewpoints and opinions about things. But when you have a complete disruptor who is coming in and making falsehoods, it's really difficult, I think, for the press to figure out how to report about that. So Hillary Clinton's emails, I think, is a great disservice. You know, they're a combination of factors. I think Jim Comey, who I know and like, I think really blew it by failing to follow Department of Justice policy about neither confirming nor denying the existence of an investigation, and upon conclusion, not disparaging a person who is not being charged with a crime. So I think that was a huge mistake. And then the press just kept reporting about it again and again and again, when, as you say, all these other issues were ignored. But I think the really tricky thing that we have not yet figured out is How do you cover someone like Donald Trump who's just lying again and again and again? I know that sometimes when he's done these town hall meetings, there will be journalists who are trying to fact check him in real time, and you just can't keep up because
too much philosophy.
It's just a word salad, and they just keep spewing, and so it's very difficult. You know, do you cover his rallies so the public can see how ridiculous these claims are? Or is it better to not give him the airtime so that people aren't fed this nonsense? I think it's really difficult. But the point about repeating things and repeating disinformation, I have a couple thoughts in mind specifically. Like, remember when Paul Pelosi, the husband of Nancy Pelosi, was beaten with a hammer in their home? Donald Trump Jr. and some others had some very snarky, completely made up, fabricated theories about why that intruder was in their home, which I won't repeat because I don't want to give it oxygen. But people reported it. Like, Donald Trump Jr. said the following is, you know, the theory. And the more you air that, people, you know, we're busy. We see headlines. We see news stories as we're walking through airports. We don't always pay attention to the granular details. So if you put that out there, there are people who will hear that little nugget and assume that it is true, and that becomes the word of mouth. So it's very difficult, and I don't think we've quite figured this out. I mean,
I know we haven't.
Yeah. I mean, do you have thoughts on this, on how Trump should be dealt with, at MSNBC with his rallies and other things?
So if we assume that people got their information from reputable sources all the time, then your proposal may be quite logical, that let's not talk about that because then people won't get misinformation. And in a world where we had three networks that largely covered the same things, that's true. You would have kept the lies from most people. The problem is the velocity with which the misinformation, the secondary part of it, spreads around the internet without access to good analysis that you might be providing on my show. And that's what we fight with, that the message gets back to my viewer.
Yeah.
You know, through somebody's uncle who saw this thing and
true.
Said. So do we equip our viewers, your readers, with the information to be able to fight back? And I guess let's go further down this road on lying. And you're talking about the velocity of it, but there's also the magnitude of it. And on page 72, your subtitle is Go Big. Mm-hmm. And you say it was Hitler who first described the effectiveness of the big lie in his manifesto, Mein Kampf. According to Hitler, a false claim becomes more believable because of its very audacity. A big lie is believable, he wrote, because people assume that no one could have the impudence to distort the truth so infamously. In the big lie, he explained, quote, there is always a certain force of credibility. Most people tell small lies from time to time, he reasoned, but find it unimaginable to tell big lies, and they project onto others the same moral reluctance. It would never come into their heads to fabricate colossal untruths, he wrote.
Yeah, so this little section of the book is called Go Big. Most of the time, I like to say Go Blue. Do we have any Go Blues in the house? Sorry, I had to see my people. Go Blue. National champ, natty baby, national champions. Sorry. Back to our serious topic. So this idea of going big, I think, is so interesting to me because all of us engage in white lies from time to time, right? I mean, my sister might say, yeah, your hair looks fine. Or my husband might say, no, that dress doesn't make you look fat, dear. But they're saying that out of a place of kindness, right? We all do that. It's courtesy. It is something that we do to be kind to other people. But as Hitler wrote in Mein Kampf, most of us would never imagine having the sheer audacity to make up a lie about something that is very important. And so, in a weird, twisted way, the bigger the lie, the more likely we are to believe it. And so, you know, this idea of a stolen election, what could be bigger than that? And it is completely made up. There was absolutely no evidence, and we know that because of all the audits that happened after the election and the lawsuits that were filed after the election and the certifications that were done. And yet, there was so much effort to try to overturn this election on the basis of fraud, and that the idea was it's so big that we can convince people it must be true. Even those members of Congress who voted against certification on January 6th, some even after the attack on the Capitol, who absolutely and certainly knew better. I know one of them was Ted Cruz, who said words to the effect of, well, if so many people believe that there was fraud in the election, don't we owe it to them just to find out whether there was fraud in the election. I mean, what could be more circular than that, right? And so it's really frightening to think how many people were convinced and remain convinced that the election was stolen. And I think a big part of it was the sheer audacity of that lie.
You on Monday, the book was launched on Tuesday, I believe, right?
Yes.
And you were in New York, being interviewed at NYU by Professor Ruth Ben-Ghiat, who specializes in disinformation. You and I are both on a special. You and Ruth were both on a special that I did on some of this stuff. Ruth was writing because there's an idea that some of the anxiety we're facing in society right now that leaves people susceptible to disinformation and misinformation is the rapid pace of social change. Ruth Ben-Ghiat writes, then you quote her in the book, over and over, when there have been periods of substantial social progress, it could be gender equity, it could be secularization, it could be racial equity, that creates a climate of extreme anxiety, extreme anger in other people who don't like this progress. These are all fears that were very active in the 1920s and 30s. This is when these strongmen figures find favor. Let's talk about that, because extreme social change isn't new. How is it we're still reacting that way? Why does that leave us more open to the nonsense that you're talking about?
Yeah, and what Ruth Ben-Ghiat writes there, I think, really rings true, because this push and movement toward authoritarianism isn't just in the United States. I mean, we're seeing it in other countries elsewhere around the world, this idea of democratic backsliding. By the way, please admire Ali's socks that say, "Believe in democracy." A round of applause for the socks. Very nice sartorial choice. And so why is this movement existing worldwide? And I think it is because of this rapid pace of change in the world. There's a book that was written in like the 1970s called Future Shock. Anybody read that book? And even that said that, you know, people will be unable to keep up with the pace of change in the world because it gets faster and faster all the time with technology and social media and other kinds of things. And so it can be a moment of fear when there are all these changes. And I think what it really requires is leadership that doesn't stoke fear, but focuses on the hope and the really great things that can come as a result of these changes. I also quote in the book Doris Kearns Goodwin, who wrote about Theodore Roosevelt. And she talked about another period in history when Theodore Roosevelt was in office. And she said that was a time of great social change. You know, we'd been through the Industrial Revolution. We had a new wave of immigrants coming from Europe. We had newspapers now that were covering frightening events around the world, world wars, and other kinds of things. And it could have been the same kind of moment where someone stoked fear and said, only I can fix it, and we should huddle and America first and be isolationist. And instead, he really embraced the idea of hope and optimism and opportunity. Like, this is a great opportunity for us to, you know, we've got all this diversity in our country. We've got all this talent. We've got all this technology. We can do all kinds of things. Think about if we were embracing the same kind of spirit that we had in the 1960s about, you know, imagining things like going to the moon and other things. We can do so much. And instead, we are turning everything inward and, you know, hiding under our rocks and fear of all of this change. And I think a leader who has an opportunist visionary view of the world could really be a game changer in terms of how we see ourselves and our American future.
I want to get a little wonkish here and move to 1996. Anybody remember that? There was an internet. It had been around since 1969, but it wasn't accessible to most of us. We were all just starting. There were online accounts, and I think there was a big Motorola wireless phone you could use. And in 1996, Congress wanted to foster innovation in technology. And they wrote in what is described, and you have quoted, that sometimes referred to as the 26 words that created the internet, Section 230 of the Communication Decency Act. And the 26 words are, no provider or user of an interactive computer service shall be treated as the publisher or speaker of any information provided by another information content provider, end quote. These are, and I'm not sure anybody understood this in 1996, maybe they did. These are very, very important words, and what they do is they insulate the carrier of that information. The carriers like to describe themselves as the utility. They're like the electrical company or the cable company. We're just, the information is passing through us. The energy is passing through us. And it insulates them legally. It protects them from nonsense that goes through their pipes.
Yeah, so this kind of legal immunity is what allows social media companies like, you know, Twitter, X, and Facebook, and you know, all these social media companies to avoid legal liability for things that are published on their sites. And so, you know, in 1996, maybe it was a good idea. The internet was a fledgling thing, and we wanted people to invest in it and to innovate and to grow. And it has. And the United States is a worldwide leader in social media and big tech, and we've created this thing. But, you know, it's a little bit like raising a baby alligator in your bathtub. You know, what started out as kind of adorable has grown into this man-eating predator, which is where we are today. And maybe it's time to rethink that. And again, you know, sometimes when you raise this idea of amending Section 230, people will take this all or nothing idea that you either have to have no liability or complete liability. And I don't think either one of those is the appropriate solution. But I think we can do some things to amend that immunity and make them somewhat responsible for the acts. You know, we have ceded what they call a utility to a bunch of, you know, billionaire bros. You know, Elon Musk, Mark Zuckerberg, Jack Dorsey, you know, they're the ones running these so-called utilities. If you're going to be a utility, maybe we ought to regulate you like a utility, right? The phone company, the lights, the water company, they got to follow some rules. And I think we can do it without regulating content because, of course, content is protected by the First Amendment. But, you know, one of the things we learned when this whistleblower at Facebook testified before Congress, her name was Frances Haugens, a data scientist, and she said the action isn't in the content, it's in the algorithms. You know, these are these computer programs that tell us what to look at and push us priorities and sorts things that we look at online. And the algorithms, she revealed, that Facebook was using were driving people to content that would generate outrage. Because the more outraged you were, the longer you stayed online. And the longer you stayed online, the more you looked at the ads. And the more you looked at the ads, the more money they made. And so she said that was the deep, dark secret of Facebook and all these other social media giants. So what do you do about that? Well, maybe you could regulate the algorithms and say you can't generate outrage. You have to sort in some other way. Or if you do, you have to at least disclose that to people so that they know they're being manipulated. One other change I would suggest is that political advertising online is also not regulated in any way. On television and on radio, we know who pays for political ads because there are rules that say so. You might hear an ad that says, you know, I'm Joe Biden and I approve this ad. You don't see that on the internet. And so we might see ads that look like they are legitimate grassroots ads, and they might be funded by Russia or some special interest in the United States. And instead, they'll have a name like the Red, White, and Blue Grandmothers of America, and we'll think that's what it is. And so just disclosure, right? That would be a modest change that would allow us to see past some of the things that are invisible to us online.
Yeah, I'm not really looking to be a dictator for a day, but if I were, my only two things, all the plugs need to be the same, and your organization has to describe what you do. And then I'll give it back.
Go for questions.
I'm about to get the hook because we want to take questions from all of you who came here. So I'm quickly rushing through the book to see the things I want to make sure that I ask you. One of the things that we're thinking about a lot these days, and that has to do with the Constitution and that has fallen victim to a great deal of disinformation, is the issue of the Second Amendment. Mm. And something you write in the book is that the idea that people need assault weapons so that they can overthrow their government is dangerous disinformation that negates the rule of law and threatens our national security.
Yeah, so this narrative has grown up around, in recent years, this idea that we need guns not to defend our homes and not for hunting, but to overthrow our government if we want to. Marjorie Taylor Greene says, guns aren't about hunting unless you're talking about hunting tyrants, maybe. Same with Matt Gaetz, talks about this idea that we need to arm ourselves and match the firepower of the U.S. government so that, if necessary, we can overthrow our government. There is no basis in law for that idea, and I think they are deliberately conflating the Declaration of Independence, which of course was a declaration of rebellion, that we are going to separate ourselves from the government of England, from our Constitution, which is our blueprint for governing. By the way, I went to Independence Hall today.
And something, right?
Pretty darn
cool.
The birthplace of the Constitution. Yeah. Pretty cool. And saw the Liberty Bell as well. So I was you know, feeling a lot of love and pride in our Constitution. But you know what it doesn't say? It doesn't say you get to have a gun to overthrow the government. Didn't see that in there. You know, the textualists who want to see the text in there? Didn't see that text isn't in there anywhere. And in fact, it's quite the opposite. The Second Amendment, in my view, is all about having a well-regulated militia and making sure people had guns to defend our government against insurrectionists or other invaders. There are also other provisions in the Constitution that say that the president has a duty to repel insurrections. There's an Insurrection Act that makes it a crime to incite insurrection, another that makes it a crime to engage in seditious conspiracy, as some of the Proud Boys and Oath Keepers were convicted of. So the idea that somehow this right to bear arms is all about overthrowing the government has zero basis in our Constitution and is, in fact, contrary to the rule of law. So that is some dangerous misinformation. Disinformation. I don't know if it is done to support the gun industry or to make us fearful or to suggest that we need guns because of all those scary other people who are out there, but I think it's all part of this same narrative that we need to hunker down and defend ourselves because it's a scary world.
The book has 291 pages of text, and it's just cheeky to read somebody's last page, so I'm not going to do that. But I do want to quote from page 286, because it is important, because you said you went to the Independence Hall, and you're talking about democracy. And you compare the strategy it takes to preserve democracy despite the will of political opportunists as akin to any human relationship. And you write, we need to care more about maintaining the relationship than getting our way. In American government, that means needing to care more about ensuring democracy than about imposing our will. This is simple words that mean a lot, that the democracy matters more than getting your way.
Right. Sometimes, you know, your candidate loses an election and you pick up and you go on and maybe you work harder in the next election, but you accept that that person is now your leader, your senator, your governor, your president, and we should all work to support them so that they can succeed. The same is true with regard to positions on policy. You know, sometimes an initiative goes through. We don't get to just disobey the ones that we dislike. The same is true with regard to our courts. Sometimes courts make decisions we don't like, but it doesn't mean we get to disobey them. I mean, right now in Texas, we have the governor who is openly defying a Supreme Court order about having razor wire on the border that has caused deaths and is making it impossible for the Border Patrol to do their job. And they're saying we're doing it because the federal government isn't doing their job to protect us, so we're doing it. I mean, that is a violation of the rule of law. That is right up there with Governor Wallace in the schoolhouse door saying black kids can't come into our school and having to send the National Guard down there to enforce it. To love America is to love democracy and to love the rule of law, and we have to preserve that. We might not get our way every time, but as long as we fight for our democracy, I think we can all live in unity and get what we want most of the time.
I will conclude my questions with that, and I will hand it over to you.
My name's Mary. I'm from Media, Pennsylvania. Yesterday, the Supreme Court agreed to hear the immunity claim for Donald Trump. Why is it going to take so long for them to hear that as opposed to, I think it was 7 weeks, if I was not mistaken?
Yes. Why so long? The wheels of justice turn slowly. I know that this is a frustrating decision for many people because I think, you know, some say this is a great win for Donald Trump. I think this is a tie for Donald Trump. You know, there's a win, there's a loss. I think there would have been the scenario that many of us would have wished for. A win for Jack Smith, I think, would have been for the Supreme Court to say, we summarily affirm the decision of the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. They got it right. No need for any further review. Do not pass go. Do not collect $200. We're done. Resume the trial immediately. I think that would have been a win for Jack Smith. A win for Donald Trump would have been that we grant your stay, Donald Trump, and you now have the normal course of 90 days to file your petition for a writ of certiorari, and then we're going to review it, and we're going to set a briefing schedule, an argument for next term starting in October of 2024. That would have been a win for Donald Trump. Instead, they put a compromise, something in between. And my guess, you know, why did it take 3 weeks to write this like two-paragraph order? I think it was because there's some, you know, compromise going on behind the scenes for this tie. And so what they said instead is, we are going to hear the merits of this, but we're going to do it on an expedited basis. Believe it or not, in Supreme Court world, April 22nd is expedited. But briefs have to be filed. The Trump team files a brief. The government files a response. The Trump team files a reply. And other organizations are allowed to file what's called amicus briefs, friend of the court. People who have a stake in the claim also get to file these briefs. And it takes time. And then they have to read all these briefs. And then they set oral argument for April 22nd. So frankly, it's 6 weeks away. That's a pretty quick time frame to do all of those things. So that's why I say it's a tie. Now, can they decide the case quickly enough so that the case can be tried and a verdict reached before the November election? I think the race is on. It's going to be tight, but I think it can. So after April 22nd, the court will have to make a decision. They usually release all of their opinions by the end of June. One hopes that they would, in light of the fact that they set an expedited briefing schedule, they might make the decision sooner than June. But even if they don't decide it till June, all right, now we're back in the court. Now, here's the other rub. Judge Tanya Chutkan promised Donald Trump, when she denied his motion and he appealed, to say, everything's stopping right now. We're currently 3 months before the trial date. You'll get those 3 months back when the case comes back to me. And so when the case comes back to her, say, end of June, now we got to have three more months, right? July, August, September. Now we're in September for the trial to start. I think it's about a 6 to 8 week trial. So can we have the trial before then? I don't know. If they go all the way to the end of June, I don't think so. I think if they decide the case earlier than that, there is room for that to happen. It's unfortunate that we've gotten to this stage. I know there are many people who complain about Merrick Garland for having dithered for a year before getting on with things. The only thing I'll say about that is you don't know what you don't know. I agree that from the outside it really looks like they dithered a bit, and I think he did it, my speculation, because it was his stated mission upon taking office that his goal was to restore the public confidence and the independence of the Department of Justice. But I think it might be one of those situations when you coach your own kid in baseball, and even though he's the best kid on the team, you bench him because you don't want to be accused of favoritism. I think maybe he worked a little too hard to just show how fair he was, and maybe wasn't quite aggressive enough in getting this thing started. But there is, I think, a glimmer of hope that this case could be decided quickly, and the case started maybe in early September, late August, and the trial completed before the election, maybe.
I don't know how much you followed the Pennsylvania background around the election and on the topic of disinformation. So Jack Smith highlighted really specific pieces of disinformation in his indictment. What can we do as citizens when the people that specifically created that specific disinformation are still sitting in the House of Representatives in the state?
Yeah.
One of them who passed it to the DOJ is still sitting in the House of Representatives down in D.C. And as someone that spends too much time on Twitter fighting with people and trying to correct the record, I feel like our Department of State was very slow originally. They tried to correct it. They've more recently put out more information to really specifically correct the disinformation. But what can we do? Because I think faith in the Department of Justice doesn't seem like it's catching up to the people that did this to us.
All right.
Yes. No, that's an excellent question. I think there's a lot of unaddressed bad behavior throughout the country relating to the effort to steal the election. I think Jack Smith was laser focused on Donald Trump. You'll notice his indictment charges only one defendant, and that is Donald Trump. He names, he refers to six unindicted co-conspirators. He does not name them. That is the Department of Justice convention. But it doesn't take a lot of work to figure out who they are. You know, it's like Sidney Powell and Rudy Giuliani, right? We know who they are. Jeffrey Clark, all these people. But they're Washington-based people. John Eastman, you know, they're his, in California. They're his inner circle who are charged. And even they weren't charged. And I think it was a decision in an effort to be strategically efficient. Maybe later he will charge them. Maybe they decide to cooperate because they know who they are too. They can see that they're in some jeopardy. Maybe they decide to cooperate. But even if not, I think he's coming for them, just not yet. I think he's going to focus on Trump, try to get that case tried. Because if you have an indictment with seven defendants, it goes like seven times slower because all those people can file motions and their lawyer gets sick and they fire their lawyer and things go on. And so that makes, you know, a trial last, you know, 3 years instead of 1 year and getting ready to go to trial. But I think there's still things that can be done for these state officials. For example, in my state of Michigan, our state attorney general has filed criminal charges against the fake electors in Michigan for attempting to defraud the voters of Michigan and forgery for signing a document that was not true and saying that they were the duly appointed electors and submitting that to the National Archives in the Senate for the election. So there's some accountability there. I worry about people who are in the legislative branch, though, as you mentioned. At the federal level, you know, the people like Jim Jordan, who, you know, I think there are some facts to suggest has some complicity, right? I don't know what that would look like. And so I say criminal exposure because I don't know. But I do worry that people who are members of Congress will evade accountability because they have the protection of the speech or debate clause, that anything they say, you know, on the floor of Congress or even in support of that outside of the floor of Congress is very protected. And so in the same way, legislators in their states, I think, can tell a story of working to protect their constituents from fraud that might make it difficult to hold them accountable. Now, there may be other people who can be held accountable, but I think legislators are going to be difficult to hold accountable.
Right there in
Both the
middle.
Bums out, that's what you can do.
I just realized you guys have sisters-in-law sweatshirts.
Thank you. Very,
right.
very
that's
pleased
cool.
to see. Way to represent. Thank you for the sisters-in-law shirts.
I'm alarmed that you are opening a book, but I mean, I love books, but...
No, she's going to read to me.
Don't make me get uninvited.
I already annotated page 262. Hi, I'm Olga Politis. I'm the New Jersey chapter leader for Media Literacy Now, and we are a nonprofit that advocates for legislation to bring media literacy education for all K-12 public school students. Thank you. Thank you. And my question is specific to this, and thank you for answering it on Studio 2 this afternoon
yes.
on WHYY. That was me who called.
Yes. I didn't yes. think
Wait, you
got
a second bite at the apple today?
I'm sorry, yes.
Wait, does Philadelphia only have one Olga? She the only one in the whole city?
So, you know, regarding legislation, last year, Governor Murphy... in New Jersey, he signed the legislation. It took us 6 years in New Jersey. We have, you know, a democratically held assembly, state senate, for the most part, the governorship. Michigan flipped their assembly and senate last year for the first time. And unless there is legislation to back up media literacy education, there is no teacher, there is no superintendent, there's no principal that is going to go to bat for our future voters and citizens. And that is why they need the protection of legislation that is going to require teachers to talk about the very things that you outline in your book. The good news is this. New Jersey is well on its way to creating the standards by which those teachers are going to be following. Here in Pennsylvania...
Olga, you're getting me in trouble.
Yes, sorry.
If you're going to read from the
yes.
book, I need you to read from the book.
Oh, okay.
You haven't gotten there yet. I'm going to get thrown
so,
out.
So my question is, how do we get citizens, for example, those in Pennsylvania, there's legislation that has been proposed. How do we get the word out to them to uplift and amplify media literacy education, as well as some of the work that nonprofits are doing so that it can get pushed along and people can then voice their concerns about it and get it done? Thank you,
Olga.
Yeah, thank you, Olga. I think that is such an important point. And, you know, since I've written the book, I have heard from a number of individuals who are working in the foundation community, in nonprofits, on various programs that teach media literacy. But wouldn't it be great if we didn't have to have all these sort of piecemeal little programs and it was part of the standard curriculum? You know, in Finland, where they have been victimized by Russian disinformation for decades, they actually do have media literacy as part of their school curriculum. And it works. It's effective. You know, kids are taught, don't just read the headline, read the news story because it might be different. Look for a second source. Don't just believe, you know, the first thing you read. Look and see if that same story is being reported elsewhere. If there is data represented in studies, what's the sample size? Was it 3 or 3 million? Because that makes a big difference. And so in teaching people these tools, I think make us better citizens so that we can discern facts. And if we're going to be a government of the people, we need to have an understanding of facts so that we can make good choices. So I applaud you for that interest. Now, what can you do specifically? Well, organize. And I think there's some very specific things you can do. One is having very clear statements of what the materials would look like. Because I think people are skeptical of media literacy as being favoring one political party over the other, you know, that you're just trying to indoctrinate people for the left or for the right and say, no, here's the neutral material. We are teaching people skills. And so I think having clear material about what it is so that people see that it is nonpartisan. I also think enlisting credible voices to support it. And so, you know, in your state, who are the voices? Athletes can be great ambassadors. News professionals, librarians, you know, people who are in the information business, credible speakers who can be the champions of this cause and how important it is. And so I think that I think we're going to get there, but we won't get there by ourselves. We have to actually do the work. And so I think doing this work, this is an idea that I'm hearing in a lot of places that is gaining some popularity. But there will be people who resist it, right? Because there are people who benefit from disinformation and who want the masses to be dumb because that's the way they can snow them and con them and convince them of their position. So there will be resistance, but I think that there are many good people of goodwill who just want our government to be better and our schools to be better. And reaching those people, I think, is the secret to success.
And Barb, I just want to first thank you for writing the book. I can't wait to read it. I just picked it up tonight. But my question is, given what we observed in the last election related to disinformation and all of your research, what most concerned you about this year's election in terms of channels and nature of disinformation?
Yes. So I think we know, based on the last election, that it's coming again, right? And this time, I imagine that people saw what worked and what didn't work, and we'll be trying to do all kinds of things. You know, one of the other things that Steve Bannon said is that, pardon my language, you have to flood the zone with shit, is what he said. And so this idea of the fog of unknowability, I'm just going to throw a lot of stuff out there, and people won't know what the facts are. In fact, a lot of facts, a lot of garbage about voting. I'm worried about the use of artificial intelligence to fool people and suppress the vote. You may have read about the situation in New Hampshire where artificial intelligence was used to replicate the voice of Joe Biden and was used in robocalls to likely Democratic voters and told you should stay home and not vote. And so, you know, it sounds pretty good. Most people, you know, believe that it was true. I don't know if they followed the advice and stayed home, but in the last election, there were some text scams where people got text messages and said, did you know you can vote by text now in this election? Great innovation. Just text your vote to this number and you don't have to go to the polls. So there's going to be a lot of disinformation out there in an effort to just discourage people from showing up because, you know, ways to win elections are win more voters or keep voters who oppose you from showing up and casting a ballot, right? Voter suppression. So I think that we know that's coming. We're going to see these deep fakes with videos of, you know, images of Joe Biden, I don't know, falling down and dropping his ice cream cone or something. You know, that's going to be some deep fake and people are going to show it over and over again and think it's true. And so how do we build resilience against those things? I know that the secretaries of state are working hard to try to build resilience. Probably not all of them. At least two of them were elected in, I think it's Indiana and Wyoming, who were election deniers. Probably red states anyway, but still not who you want in the Secretary of State's office overseeing your elections. But I know in my home state of Michigan, for example, Jocelyn Benson, who's a phenomenal from Philadelphia, right? All right. local girl makes good. She's a phenomenal Secretary of State, and I know her office is already working on these things to try to give voters good information online, ambassadors out in the community, and educating voters about how they cast their ballot. You know, how do you vote by mail? What are the deadlines? Making sure that's very clear so that when the disinformation comes, not if but when, there will be good resources out there to combat that. But it's coming, and we need to educate ourselves so that we can inform our friends and our family and our neighbors.
I got to wrap it up. I know I could have gone on for another 3 hours with these great questions that you've all got, so I apologize for not being able to get more in here, but I thank you all for your wonderful questions. For those of you who have not read the book, you are going to love it. Barbara, thank you for writing it. Thanks for being such a great friend, and I know you're going to go out there and sign some books now.
Thank you very much.
Barbara McQuaid.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.